This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the SportsMap Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Well, the Sweet 16 continuing tonight. Four more games. If you watched any of them yesterday, there was a lot of stuff to like, and there was a lot of stuff not to like. The officiating in the Arkansas-Gonzaga game, for example, wasn't really that good. Nevertheless, the Razorbacks were able to get down the number one seed in this tournament and take them out. And then Arizona was absolutely manhandled by the Houston Cougars. Kelvin Sampson is a win away from going to back-to-back Final Fours with this Houston club. Arizona looked to me like the best team coming into this tournament. That's why they were my pick. And even though they had a tough game against TCU, an overtime game, I thought they had one of the best players in the tournament in Benedict Mathurin. But Houston dismantled Arizona, just dismantled them. Duke, Texas Tech was a classic. The problem, though, is that games that are in the Sweet 16 tend not to live on that level of classic because there wasn't a last-second shot or anything like that. But it was Duke being absolutely perfect at the free throw line and on the floor in the final 5 minutes of that game, helping them propel them to a victory over Texas Tech, the best defensive team in the country. And then Villanova got in a little bit of a fight with Michigan, but in the end, the Wildcats were a better team. They showed that they were a better team and now advanced. So, America, are you ready for tonight? Are you ready for the St. Peter's Peacocks and their fun run into this tournament to invade your lives once again? Because tonight they're going to get Purdue, and Purdue's got size, but St. Peter's has got that heart and that spunk. No, I'm just kidding. It's everything you say when a Cinderella story gets this far. Of course they've got heart. Of course they've got confidence. It's how you get to the Sweet 16 as a 15 seed from the MAC in the first place. But number one seed Kansas is the only number one seed left. Now, I gave you bad advice at the beginning of the tournament. Never listen to me, by the way, but I'm going to give you advice anyway. But never listen to me. Do the opposite. I told you when you add up the seedings of the Final Four, keep it around 8 or 9. There's going to be a couple of ones in there, 2s and 3s. It looks like that number is going to be pretty high. Now the 3 number ones are out, and Kansas is the only one still left. Because you're going to get, there's North Carolina at 8, there's Iowa State, there's Miami. By the way, Miami's a 10 and Iowa State's an 11. One of those teams is playing for a right to go to the Final Four coming up this weekend. We'll get to that, but Lee Ellis is going to join us next to talk NBA from The Athletic. We'll talk to him about the league as we continue with Wake Up Call.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, let's go to the Progressive Guest Line. We're talking some NBA as we head to the stretch run before we get to the playoffs. Our good friend Lee Ellis joining us from The Athletic to talk NBA. How are you, my friend?
Very well, thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me this morning.
Big weekend for Brooklyn. They play at home on Sunday against Charlotte, and Kyrie Irving is going to be able to play in the Barclays Center now. What was your evaluation of this team when they didn't have him on the floor, and how much better, obviously, are they with him? And what does this mean now for Brooklyn in the 8th spot in the East?
Well, it's very interesting because the assumption is that they are better with Kyrie Irving. But in the 20 games he's played, Brooklyn is only 8-12. So, you know, it's one of those things where the eye test says, well, Brooklyn's much better. They've got their all-star, all-NBA player back. But so far, they haven't really been able to prove that on the court. And I think you've got a really good insight into that in their last game, that loss in Memphis on Wednesday night without Ja Morant for the Grizzlies. And the Grizzlies got off to a good start, and then the Nets came back. And Kyrie had a good individual game. But in the end, you know, Memphis really pulled away and dominated that victory. And I think, that, you know, the takeaway I get from that is these guys simply haven't had enough reps together, not just this season, but the entire time KD and Kyrie Irving have been in Brooklyn. They've only played, you know, relatively speaking, a handful of games together. So they're still trying to figure out that chemistry. Having said all that, of course, the playoffs, it is a completely different time because, you know, you've got guys who have been to the finals. Kyrie is obviously a champion with Cleveland, and Kevin Durant, we know, you know, he's a 2-time champ there with the Warriors. So they're certainly going to be a tough out, but I'm not of the opinion that Brooklyn just now automatically becomes the favorite in the Eastern Conference simply because, you know, as I mentioned, the record there with Kyrie and, you know, to win the championship from 7th or 8th, wherever they finish up, is very, very difficult still to do. You have to win every single series on the road. And you're going up against some very good teams, you know, potentially Miami or Milwaukee in the first round, even Philadelphia, even though Brooklyn would probably pick Philadelphia out of those three teams simply because of the way that they demolished them a few weeks ago there in the, you know, alleged or the supposed Ben Simmons return game. He obviously didn't end up playing. But then you've also got someone like the Boston Celtics, who's probably playing the best basketball of anybody in the Eastern Conference right now, and they're in the fourth spot. So I think, you know, obviously for Brooklyn, they want their best, strongest team out there. But statistically, you know, Kyrie has still got sort of a lot to sort of figure out as far as how they actually get the best out of everybody out there playing. So if you're in the Eastern Conference and you're one of those top seeds, you certainly shouldn't fear the team that is seventh or eighth, even if they have Kevin Durant on their team, because they haven't yet shown us over a long period of time, you know, it's only been a small sample size, that they actually can be a favorite on the road in a potential seven-game series.
Is it different than like a star player being out for a long period of time with injury and then coming back? Does Steve Nash have he's got to really make this continuity established before they get to the playoffs, or is that overblown?
Well, no, I think it's true, because when a guy's injured, he can't be out on the court, you know, and often you'll see teammates, you know, or you hear about it behind the scenes, you know, they're always encouraging their guy to work hard, to get his body right, to get out there and be ready as best he can. You know, Klay Thompson's a good example in Golden State. I mean, the whole team was really behind him coming back out on the court and playing. Now, he's found it a little bit hard to get his rhythm back simply because he's been in and out of lineups a little bit and he missed nearly 2.5 years. But I think Kyrie, you know, what he was doing was saying to his teammates, I'm simply not available for our home games. And that, I think, does create a little bit of a different feeling within the locker room, because guys are trying to build chemistry, they're trying to work together, and he simply just wasn't there. So that's, I think, the other part why you see them 8-20. You think, you know, offensively they've got incredible talent there with Kyrie and KD, but they don't yet have that chemistry, I don't think, where the ball's really moving around and everyone's getting involved. It's a lot more sort of top-heavy stuff, where it's like, we know these two guys can get buckets, so what are the other guys doing out on the court? Are they really feeling a part of the offense? And that's going to be the biggest challenge, I think, for Steve Nash over these last, you know, 10 games, 11 games, whatever it is, a couple of weeks here, to get everybody to really buy in. And that's going to be something that is very, very important to see if Brooklyn can get it together in a playoff series.
So, Lee, I'm going to tell you that I understand two things. I understand the competitive nature amongst teammates can get overblown, and I also know we're in a clickbait culture where quick videos make for, you know, 10,000 million, you know, hits. Is that situation in Miami, is that real? Is that a concern, or is that just an over, you know, just a bunch of boiling over, if you will? We see it a lot.
Yeah, we do, but we never see Eric Spoelstra that animated.
Right,
and that,
yeah,
to me, is where it's a little bit different. If you think of the Miami Heat, you know, love them or hate them, they're one of the most stable franchises in the NBA. You know, they have been for a long time, because very stable ownership and front office there, and that does filter down to the coaching staff. So for Eric Spoelstra to lose his head like that, and I mean, he was hot for, you know, what, over a minute there. That is just an eternity for somebody like him. And the other thing is, Jimmy Butler, you know, everywhere he's gone, he's kind of left under a bit of a cloud there as well. Even in Chicago, it didn't work out. Minnesota, he basically screamed his way out of there. And in Philadelphia, he only lasted 5 minutes before he was also fighting with the coaching staff in the front office there. So, you know, I think there's a little bit more to it there than just, oh, that was just a blow-up. But I will say, for the Miami Heat, maybe they can spin this in a positive way, because part of the reason Jimmy left those situations was he wasn't challenged by the coaching staff in the front office. They almost bowed to him. So instead, you've got Eric Spoelstra saying, you're going to be held accountable like everybody else. And maybe Jimmy responds to that. I mean, they responded immediately in the game in that third quarter. They got back into it, but then they ended up losing by double digits in the end. So it's fascinating to see a team, as I say, as well sort of structured and as well controlled as they usually are, the Miami Heat, sort of pulling away a little bit from the scene, because they're the top seed in the Eastern Conference. They should hang on to that, but if they don't, and you wonder if they get into a situation in the playoff series where they're down or they're behind, will this sort of rear its ugly head again? I think that's a bit of a concern for Miami, something they haven't had in years gone by.
We talked about Boston, as hot as they are. What is clicking right for the Celtics right now?
Oh, man, that ball movement on offense is just a thing of beauty right now. You saw it against the Utah Jazz, one of the best perimeter defensive teams in the league. And the Celtics were basically almost mocking them. It was like they're just flinging the ball around. Whoever was going to get it knew that I'm going to get a shot. And if I don't get a shot on this possession, I know it's coming. And that's a sign, of a team with really good chemistry, because they all understand that they're going to get their opportunity. And when they do, they knock it down and they're all on each other's, supporting each other really, really well. So they're playing incredible basketball. Their defense is fantastic. I mentioned on our show the other day, it feels like when Boston's playing defense right now, they have six guys on the court because everybody understands what's expected of them, where to go, how to close out, how to shut down a guy, how to rotate over and help. And those are the sorts of things that Ime Udoka, the coach, really preached coming into this season. It took him probably half a season to get that message through, but now it's there. And Boston just look like the best team in the Eastern Conference right now. Now, again, playoffs are going to be different. Teams, they plan and strategize differently. But right now they've got no injuries. They've got their superstar talent playing at the highest level. They're deep. They're playing defense. There's a lot to like about where Boston is right now.
Let's go to the West. And Phoenix was a really fun team to watch last year, making their way through the postseason and getting to the finals. This is as equally or even better team now. Chris Paul's returned. They've locked up the overall seed. Do you anticipate Phoenix managing load for the rest of the way to the postseason just to make sure everything is good before they make a run?
I think that's obviously tempting right now for Monty right. Williams because, what we saw last season in the playoffs, Chris Paul gets injured in, I think, the second game against the Lakers. Now, he managed to get back. But I also think, and I took this out of the game last night against Denver, that Monty Williams is like, listen, we don't want to mess with anything right now. We don't want to show any sort of sign of cruising to the finish line here before we get to the playoffs because that can maybe change the mentality of guys. Because they had a tough back-to-back. They were in Minnesota on Wednesday night, and then they go to Denver for a team that was rested for a second night of a back-to-back. And the Suns were down in the fourth quarter here, and they fought back, and really, you could see Devin Booker. It meant a lot to those guys to clinch the best record in the league, to win the 60 games, to show every team they mean business every night. So I think Monty, maybe Chris Paul, because he's 37, he takes another game or two off towards the end here. But I think for the most part, the other guys probably are going to play it out here simply because I think it's that, like, they don't want to mess with the chemistry. They just don't want to sort of mess with the basketball gods, if you believe in that sort of stuff. And I think it's more about sending a message to the rest of the league that we believe we are the favorites. They should be. I mean, they've been the best team all season long. And they try to send that message that they mean, they're going out to win every single game, despite the fact that they're not technically playing for anything anymore for the remainder of the regular season.
There are a lot of good teams in the West, and some of those teams are dealing. Ja Morant is out with Memphis right now. Golden State's got some injuries. In terms of some teams, though, to watch out for in the West, where do you put the Dallas Mavericks?
Yeah, they're a very interesting team because I kind of dismissed the Mavericks early into the season. I thought they're too reliant on guys just getting hot from the perimeter every night. And Luka has to do, like, so much. But I just didn't think they had a sustainable way of winning. But now, since the trade, I mean, they basically made that trade with Washington, not because they wanted Spencer Dinwiddie and Davis Bertans, because they wanted to get off the Kristaps Porzingis contract, but they've actually turned that into an incredible trade. Spencer Dinwiddie has been fantastic for them. I believe they're 10-3 since the trade, and Dinwiddie has just been incredible. He's hit a couple of game winners for them, and he's really given Luka that extra ball handler and creator and scorer that they've desperately needed. I think they're still a little bit small. I mean, Dwight Powell's kind of their biggest big who plays. I mean, Boban's there, but he doesn't play. So they do have a little bit of a gap in the middle. And against a team like Phoenix, DeAndre Ayton could really pound them inside, I think. But right now, what Dallas is doing well is everybody is out there and they're spreading the floor and they're allowing Luka to create and also get his shot. But then he can actually pass to other guys with confidence and they're able to score. The only question really is for Dallas, as we've seen, they've made the playoffs two times in the Luka era, both times against the Clippers, and he's been incredible. I think he averaged 37 a game against the Clippers last season, but they lost. And part of that was they didn't get that help in the playoffs. So from what I'm seeing today, I think they're a much better team than they were last season, but we still have to see it in a playoff series where teams, as I said earlier, they defend differently. Their strategies are different. When you've got games to plan rather than just a one-off game, teams can really focus in on saying, right, Luka is not going to go for 40 tonight. These other guys are going to have to step up and do what they've done in the regular season if they're going to beat us in a playoff series. And that's going to be the challenge for Dallas, is can those guys do what they've done so far when there's a playoff series on the line? And that's a question that is really going to be interesting to see how the Mavs answer it.
I want to keep you for one more question. I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit. It's about an injury, but I want your thoughts as somebody who's really on top of this league. Are we ever going to see Zion Williamson play again? What is his situation? And because it seems like he's got Greg Oden written all over him.
Well, I would have believed that until earlier this week when we saw that video that he posted on his Instagram of him doing the off the backboard between the legs dunk. I mean, that's the most agile we've seen from him in 2 years now. So I am optimistic that the young guy can, he's got enough time here to get himself back on track. He certainly has to manage those injuries properly, and it's been a bad season for New Orleans. Like the PR has taken a hit because it seems like they're not on the same page. But if he can get out there next season and play, then I do believe he averaged 27 a game in the games he played last season. I mean, he's no doubt he's got the talent, but whether or not he can keep his body healthy and strong enough for the grind of an NBA season is going to be the question. So I certainly don't want to put him in the Oden category just yet. I believe he will be able to get out there on the court, but three seasons in, and he hasn't been able to get through a full season or even close to it so far, it's certainly a concern, especially when it's foot injuries for a guy who's, he's a heavy guy, he's a big guy. Those are the sorts of things that can become a problem. I mean, that's kind of what it was there for Oden. So, and we've seen it before. Brandon Roy's another example with his meniscus in his knees, wasn't able to really sustain in the NBA. So I hope that's not the case for Zion. I choose to believe that he will be able to be the player that we all saw in Duke there a few years ago and was the lock for a number one pick, 2 years before the draft, I think it was. So hopefully he can come back and prove us all right.
All good talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much. We'll catch up with you when the postseason hits. Thank you so much as always.
Anytime, Tony. Thanks very much for having me.
You got it. Lee Ellis of The Athletic. No Dunks podcast, by the way. You want to really know some things of what's going on in the NBA. One thought on Zion Williamson and Duke and how it all kind of comes back to Coach Mike Krzyzewski when we return on Wake Up Call.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the SportsMap Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Lee Ellis of The Athletic. His thoughts on Zion Williamson, I wanted to get that in because, you and I talked about it. Yeah, he did have that nice video, but I'm with him. I hope he does return to this league. When you think about Duke basketball, for example, and I saw this really great write-up about Mike Krzyzewski, about really it was basically the history of Duke, and it wasn't really like pointing out all the players, but it was sort of putting everything in sort of this sort of big picture idea of what Mike Krzyzewski was and is to college basketball. And when you think about it, this guy, as we've talked about before, this guy has seen the evolution of his sport and he has stayed with the same school. So when he walks into Cameron or he walks into where his office is, he may pass where his office was because, they've built out obviously the complex or whatnot. But he walks and parks and walks through that campus, and he has done so for 42 years where he can sort of remember everything about the way the sport has grown. He got into a college basketball world where players stayed for 4 years, and he made the most of it. And then when there was the one-and-dones, he adapted and brought in some of the best talent in the sport to play just 1 year at Duke. But as this write-up brought out, I think it was Roger Sherman at The Ringer, had brought out that Coach K was always really the star. Maybe like Christian Laettner, because Laettner was beyond, kind of in another universe. But when you think about the J.J. Reddicks and the Shane Battiers and the Jay Williams and all of the guys that played, it's too numerous, right? In the end, it was stars that centered around the universe of Mike Krzyzewski at Duke. You were always going to be a Coach K guy, right? No matter how good you were and in how separate you were from the program. Once you put that Duke uniform on, you were going to be forever associated with Coach K. He was the ringleader. You were the circus act, even if you were the best circus act that they had, right? There was only one person that broke out of that. I think it was only one person whose star outshined Coach K, and that was Zion Williamson. I think people really wanted to watch him play, and they couldn't have cared less about anything about Duke or anything about their tradition or anything about some ACC rivalry down Tobacco Road. I think America wanted to see this extremely talented force of nature play college basketball, knowing what he was going to be able to do in the NBA. And again, I will put any one of the Mike Krzyzewski stars against the star of Zion Williamson, and I don't think it's close. And Duke has had a lot of great basketball players. Now, I'm not talking about Duke legacy. I'm just talking about image. I'm just talking about the way that particular athlete is different than other athletes who do the exact same thing, which is play basketball at Duke. And I think that's what made Zion such an interesting story even to this day, is that I think, and he was right, we projected this kid to be the first round pick in the draft before he even got to college. And if LeBron had gone to college, any school, how would LeBron James back then, and if you remember, you all remember the hype of LeBron James, right? We cover of Sports Illustrated in high school, all of those things, right? In fact, they've got an ad now, right? I think, is it a crypto ad where he's talking to a younger self?
Yeah, I think so. Right?
I think it's for cryptocurrency. See, I don't even know what it is. I just know what the ad, that there's an ad with LeBron talking to his CGI younger self. But if LeBron had gone anywhere, and I don't care where he would have gone, he would have shined brighter than anything about that school at that particular time. Outshine the coach, other good players, whatever. LeBron was that kind of that kind of hype machine. And Zion was like that too. We all knew, like, Bobby Hurley coming out of Jersey City was going to be, was a high recruit. We knew Trajan Langdon, the Alaskan assassin, right? All of the guys that played at Duke, right, always came in with some sort of pedigree. Kyrie Irving, who played very little at Duke, but still went to Duke, right? But nobody outshined the program like Zion Williamson. And Krzyzewski, I got to be honest with you, that's more of a testament to him and his star power than really on Zion Williamson. To outshine all of those guys, again, I think Christian Laettner is sort of the outlier, but Danny Ferry, Mark Allery, Jay Billis, Tommy Amaker, Johnny Dawkins, Grant Hill, I mean, name them all. Brian Davis, right? Cherokee Parks. Right? Grayson Allen, J.J. Redick. I mean, name them all. Mike Krzyzewski was always the star of that group. He was the head coach, the longtime head coach. He was a guy that could take any recruiting class to a Final Four. He was a guy that took multiple different teams to the championship. He was the star. Zion was the only one that I think outshined him. And that says a lot about Zion, because to go to a place like Duke and have that kind of power, have that kind of a draw, really doesn't exist. But Krzyzewski managed all of that. Krzyzewski managed the four-year guys that stayed 4 years and developed those relationships. He watched immature players come in as freshmen who thought they knew it all and thought that they were going to be the next big thing. And he watched them mature to leaders and people who understood exactly what they could contribute and exactly what were things that they were better off giving to other people to contribute. And he always loved that process. He loved it with Laettner. He loved it with Hurley. And he loved it with anybody that stayed and was a star on his team for 3 to 4 years. But the moment this sport went, hey, you're going to get guys in here for one shot only, then they're going to the NBA, he had to figure out how to do it. He wasn't going to be like John Calipari. He wasn't going to be like other coaches. He wasn't going to be like Jerry Tarkanian at UNLV and grab guys that, could be a problem down the road. He got guys, and he got guys to come in. He would play them for that 1 year. He would utilize them for the 1 year. He would help them get to the NBA, but it never diminished his program. Mike Krzyzewski, incredible career.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue this Wake Up Call on SportsMap Radio. So, you ready tonight for the St. Peter's Peacocks, Ron Culver?
I'm ready.
We ready for their game against Providence? That's what's going to kick off tonight in the big Sweet 16 Part 2 this evening. The last game on the schedule is Iowa State-Miami. I don't blame you if you kind of check out of that one. That might be a really good game, but you know, it's two teams that, you know, hey, we're so excited to be here. Look what we just did. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So St. Peter's has got the fun 15 seats. I didn't realize this, but they were in a bracket where 13 teams in their bracket had at least one Final Four appearance in the school's history. I was like, oh wow, I didn't realize that.
Well, they got
to
do it.
But
then.
That didn't seem to make sense. I got to look that one up just to make sure that's an accurate statement. But nevertheless, it shows how tough it was for them to get where they are right now. Murray State and Kentucky beating both of them. North Carolina and UCLA should be a pretty good game. North Carolina's got a flair of confidence about them. UCLA's, you know, coming off a Final Four run last year. Providence and Kansas, St. Peter's and Purdue. Providence is sneaky good. Like, I didn't believe in Providence. I didn't have them getting this far. I don't think they'll beat Kansas, but Providence is a decent team I should not have ignored. But, yeah, St. Peter's and Purdue tonight. Well, that'll be in Philadelphia to get things rolling. The other games will be in Chicago. So, and you have last night, you have Houston and Duke winning. You have Villanova and Arkansas winning. I know a lot of people went on Twitter last night to complain about the officiating in the Arkansas-Gonzaga game. You're not lying. It wasn't that good. There were a couple of bad calls against Gonzaga. Not taking anything away from Arkansas, but yeah, it was not a good look.
I'm just looking ahead here. What if we get a Final Four pairing of Duke versus North Carolina?
Wouldn't that be cool? That'd be great.
Yeah.
And that could happen.
It could happen.
Is that how they line up? The East versus the West?
The East versus West. That's a Final Four. It wouldn't be a national title game.
No, but it would be
a Final Four.
Trying to think. I don't think he's ever faced North Carolina in the Final Four before.
I mean, that would be the storybook ending.
I can't remember.
That would be a do you believe in miracles moment, because if Duke was able to beat North Carolina in the Final Four, would we even think about the national title game?
That's very true. Duke, I'm trying to think if he's ever played North Carolina. I've been following this
tournament?
Guy since the 80s. I don't think they've ever met in the tournament.
It would be an odd one because since they're
Duke is like one of those teams I kind of can remember every way they've went down.
Yeah, but very rarely. I mean, how many ACC teams have they played?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really hard. It really takes a committee to try to set that up on purpose. Usually, they're two very good teams. Normally, North Carolina and Duke in years past have been sort of equal in the seeding, so you would shove one in one place and the other in another place. You know, you very rarely would they be one on top of the other, two down. But yeah, so I don't think they've ever played North Carolina. I would have remembered that. I got to think that even in like the early 90s, if they did, that I would have remembered that. But remember, like Dean Smith had a very good basketball team. Duke had a run of two national championships in 91 and 92, but you know who won in 93? That was North Carolina. North Carolina beat Michigan with Weber calling the timeout. So North Carolina's had just as good of teams as Mike Krzyzewski in the heydays of the program.
Well, this should help you out.
Yeah.
The last time, and I think it's the only time, that two teams from the same conference played against each other.
Was in the Final Four or any at all?
I think in the tournament. Since the tournament expanded in 1985. Well, this was an article in 2014, so that makes it a little bit easier for us. But only two teams from the same conference have faced off against each other, and that was Villanova against Georgetown.
That was in the finals of 85.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, because, well, that was the last time, right?
That was I think that was the last time. I'm looking to see.
Yeah, because that Final Four in 85 had three Big East teams. So one of them would have, somebody would have played. I think it was St. John's that played. I think St. John's played Georgetown, and Villanova played Memphis State, now Memphis, in that Final Four.
It was in Lexington, Kentucky. That's one of my favorite Final Fours of my youth. That was
Villanova, Georgetown?
Yeah, that was one of my
favorites. Raleigh Massimino?
That was Raleigh Massimino, and that was Villanova playing nearly a perfect basketball game. Everything, and they only won by a handful of points. And yet they shot lights out. Ed Pinckney, Gary McLean. That was a fun Villanova team with Raleigh Massimino. And they went up against the juggernaut Georgetown Hoyas. And John Thompson leading the way with Patrick Ewing on his team. That's when the Big East was the Big East, baby. But yeah, I think the committee does a pretty good job of trying to avoid that. I think they want the variety of matchups.
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean? I think they're very wary of that. Doesn't mean it can't occur.
No, I'm looking here. Thing. I mean, there's another article that says, you know, for the Final Four, it happens quite often.
Yeah, because you know, once you get to the Final Four, it's
you have top teams. That's why
you have top
teams. Like, you know, or top conferences, ACC. You know, if they, you know, it should happen to the Big Ten this year, right? I mean, they sent 9 teams. But,
you would think somehow, it would
but
come,
all of them
it would
flamed
together.
Out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And so, ACC, you know, that's a dominant basketball conference. They've done it a couple of times.
If Kansas loses tonight, I would love somebody statistically, history, to tell me if this is the earliest exit of all the number one.
That's a good
seeds.
Question.
I think it is. If you have all your number ones out before the Elite Eight, that is got to be the fastest tournament of eliminating all 4 number one seeds in the history of the tournament, even since it's expanded.
Yeah.
You got to think being a number one seed gets you to at least the Elite Eight. One is going to the Final Four. We rarely have Final Fours that don't have one of the 4 teams.
Can't think of a Final Four where we didn't.
All right. You usually get one of them in there, if not two. The one year we had all 3, remember that one? That was like 2006 or something.
There wasn't one year we had all 4.
We did. It was Kevin Love and his UCLA.
That's right.
UCLA team was part of that. I want to say it was the time Memphis played Kansas for the national championship. I think it was that year, but I'm not sure. See, my memory gets cloudy with all these years. That's my problem. I start remembering different things. You know what I remember about that one in particular? Was that John Calipari's kids couldn't hit free throws. That was Derrick Rose that was on the team. They couldn't hit free throws to save their life. They couldn't hit free throws at all. They would have won that game going away against Kansas. But they couldn't hit free throws at all. And they lost the national championship. Calipari would then win one with Kentucky in 2012 with Anthony Davis. But couldn't win that one. So, but I think it was either the 2000. I want to amend that. I think it's either the 2007 or 2008 Final Four. God, it's one of those things where I'm going to look that up now because now that's on my brain. I think it was that Final Four that had all number one seeds. It was UCLA and Kevin Love.
I'm looking at it here. The first 2011, I think, was the last time we didn't have a number one in the Final Four.
Okay, that was UConn.
That was UConn over Butler.
And Butler. And VCU was in that Final Four, too.
Look at your memory.
I know,
you got
man.
That memory going.
Stop me right now before I embarrass myself.
It was 2008 was all 4 number ones.
Was that the year Kansas won the national
championship? Kansas over Memphis.
That's right. Okay, so that was the
and
year.
UCLA, North Carolina were the other two.
Right, okay. Okay, so that was all 4 number ones.
Yeah,
now
that's always have. But I
always say, do not do that in your bracket. Do not go chalk in your bracket because it doesn't happen. It happens
right.
So rarely. We, you know, we need a little struggle, but we remember when it has. So now let's get back to the elephant in the room for this thing because the team that's
Saint
not
Peter's?
Playing this weekend, yeah, St. Peter's. The team that's not playing this weekend is Gonzaga, and people are gonna. I'm telling you right now, Gonzaga went from in the span of 20 years. Gonzaga went from a, wow, isn't this great? They're so good. I'm rooting for them. To, when the hell are you going to win a national championship?
Yeah.
And if you don't, don't even come to me with your number one overall seed nonsense.
Listen, former friend of ours, I don't know, I can't say former friend, former colleague who's better, but Matt Perrault actually put out a decent tweet.
Okay.
When is
you say that surprisingly?
Yeah, I do. I'm sorry.
He actually put out a
he
decent
put out
tweet
a decent
once.
Tweet that wasn't self self. I don't know. Whatever. Anyways, what he had said was, When is the committee going to stop giving Gonzaga number one seeds?
I would argue with Matt on this. I understand where he's coming from, and I kind of agree with it. But I would say, but if I was on the committee, I would say, Matt, I can't give them a number two because of the history of the tournament.
Yeah.
I am supposed to give the seeding based on November to now. Like, it's not a history. Oh, they stink or they lose and they lose in the early. I can't. I'm supposed to. Because
but
it's
are we
not
given
a team that's bringing you the same players for 20 years. It's a they're different teams. Jalen Suggs wasn't on this team and Chet Holmgren was, right?
But are we giving the West Coast too much credit here?
Now, that argument. Okay, that argument, I kind of see the point. I remember when we talked to Patrick Stevens about this, and I asked him about that. I said, is this valid? I mean, this whole West Coast Conference thing, is it valid? I mean, it's not just me saying it. Like, this is the number one thing people say about Gonzaga.
Listen, you should just be one team from that conference. You know, if you won the tournament, you got in.
Right.
And, you know, then every once in a while we're like, well, St. Mary's did a good job. Let's throw them a double digit seed just for S's and G's. And now it feels like every single year it's like, well, okay, you know, yeah, Gonzaga, you guys won. St. Mary's, well, you know, we're gonna give you your due. You're always there as well. But is it justified?
Yeah, that's the whole thing, right? I mean, again, it's their conference that doesn't really prepare them for the kind of difficulty that this tournament is in. But here's Patrick Stevens again from the Washington Post made a very good point. Look, it's hard. This tournament is hard. It's not easy. It's, you know, like Mike Krzyzewski has had great basketball players. He's been there 43 years.
Right.
43 years. He's got 5 national championships, and those seem like 3 too many for an average coach to have. Jim Boeheim has won.
Right.
John Calipari has won. Right? I mean, we're talking about John Calipari, who not just the Memphis head coach. He was a UMass coach with Marcus Camby. He's been at Kentucky forever and a day and has only gotten one. These are hard to get. Are we ripping Mark Few, who arrived at Gonzaga in 99? He's been to 2 national championships games. He has played on the Magical Monday twice in the last 5 tournaments. That's not bad. But we don't want Gonzaga losing all the time like this. Because you're right. The committee goes, Matt Peralta is on to something, right? Where the conference is weak enough that Gonzaga shouldn't get any real currency for
being 31-2.
Blowing that conference out every night, right? Like, I get where he's saying. But maybe that's where the real argument is.
Yeah, I think it's more a conference thing than it is a Gonzaga thing.
Right. Like, Gonzaga's got talented players, right? Chet Holmgren is going to be a top pick in the draft.
Yep.
Drew Timmy can play. Jalen Suggs can play. They've got great players.
They're going to get drafted.
Right. But in the end, right, if you're just rolling through double digits every night, blasting through your conference, how good are you really? Because when you get to this thing, you lose. You're out in the second round, out in the third round, out in the Sweet 16, out in the Elite Eight, out in the national championship game. Find me the location. Mark Few has lost it, other than the play-in game, right? Final Four, runner-up, Sweet 16, 32, first round, Elite Eight. He has taken a team and taken them to that location and lost in the 20. Something years that he's been the head coach. He's got there in 99. His first year was 99-2000. So 21 years. Take the COVID year out, 20 seasons of tournaments, 20 tournaments, and he has found every which way to lose. So, nevertheless. Yeah. All right, we'll come back, wrap up the show, get you prepared for the weekend as we continue with the Wake Up Call.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sportsnap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for listening this morning. Get you set for the weekend. Again, 4 games today, and then, of course, this weekend with the NCAA tournament, we will know who will be going to the Final Four in New Orleans coming up next week. And you know what? When the Final Four is in New Orleans next week, you know what that means? The next few days after that are the Masters. We're rolling right into April, baby.
Yep.
Before you know it, the playoffs of spring training will be over. Opening day in baseball will be on April 7th for a lot of teams. April's coming up, the draft at the end of the
month. And then remember, we talked about earlier today, mid-April, you can go see 4th and 12th.
That's right.
On Sidekicks.
Yeah, on USFL, that's right. The draft's in Las Vegas this year, right?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. Very good. So you got a lot of stuff coming up in the month of April. Real quick, the USA and Mexico 0-0 tie, does that hurt them?
No, that American actually helps
chances?
Them.
It helps them?
That helps them because you wanted to get some sort of point from Mexico. They got a point. Canada lost yesterday. So they play again, I believe, Sunday or Monday. And if they win that game, they're in the World Cup.
Yeah, okay. So they're not in yet.
They're not in yet. No team out of our region has qualified yet. But
okay.
If USA wins, if Mexico wins, and Canada wins, like they all, you know, hopefully they will do, those will be your three teams representing the CONCACAF in the World Cup.
If you were to give it a percentage between 0 and 100, 100 guaranteeing that they're in 0, what's their percentage of getting in?
Well, they're playing against Panama, which is kind of tricky, but I would say it's, you know, I would say definitely in the 80s.
Okay, very good. I need the United States in the World Cup.
We do.
I really, really want them to be in the World Cup. Because then we can, you know, in the fall, we can have a really good time with that. We'd love that. All right. Everybody, enjoy your week, and we'll be back Monday to talk Final Four and who's in, who didn't make it in, all of that good stuff. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio. Thanks for joining us.